bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by Wired Tree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to After Things. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hello, hello, hello.
Mr. Brian Brushwood.
Yo!
Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hi, everybody. That's me.
Gentlemen, question for you.
Yes.
We're not going to do picks, but we're going to talk about books or things we've been reading that have influenced us a lot and just go around here and sort of hear each person say something.
We touched real briefly on the main show. I'm so fascinated to hear.
Brian, I'm flattered you call it the main show, but really it's called Weird Things.
On Weird Things. You mentioned, I got to admit, it's a bit shocking to me that to hear that Matt Ridley didn't feel like he accomplished everything he had hoped to with The Rational Optimist, because that might be like a top five fundamental life-changing book for me. It's so interesting. That along with The Righteous Mind and some others.
I'm paraphrasing and reading between the lines that I think that he has made some wonderfully cogent arguments before. And I want to clarify, like, I think that for him, I think it was a powerful book, but I think that he wanted to try to really sort of make this case sort of as a way to sort of do this. And I think that that's what the new book, How Innovation Works, is really trying to get into the heart of how innovation is what pulls us out of these things.
Yeah, that I guess whenever somebody asks like for just a general recommendation, it was a magical year that I had that perfect trifecta of reading The Rational Optimist, followed by Abundance, and then the next book I read was Better Angels of Our Nature, the Pinker book, and I was mm-hmm. late to that one. And then later Thinking Fast and Slow or whatever, but what a remarkable, just mind-blowing 1-2-3 punch that was for me in terms of, and for the unfamiliar, we've talked about them a lot, but basically the overall thesis is not only are things not as bad as you think, they're better than they've ever been. Yes, including World War II. Like, even if you loop in World War II in there, just objectively by every standard, everything is better than it's ever been. And it very much looks, if you look at the data and you were a betting person, that things are only going to get better from here, which is just a remarkable thing.
And we need to clarify too, because every time we say this is people will just sort of get to the end of that statement and they won't read the rest of it. We're talking for people at the bottom. We're talking for people economically, for the poorest people on the planet. And whenever we talk about, and that's an argument that Matt's made and others have made, is like, when we talk of prosperity, and the rich get richer, like, yeah, and the poor are getting things like running water and electricity, and these things are happening. Not as fast as we want, but the bottom 30% have had their quality of life has improved dramatically over the last 100 years. And that's a thing that just frustrates me, because every time we bring up like, oh, how look great are I? Like, oh, what about these people? Like, no, that's who we're talking about.
Well, and I think that that's a general theme of understanding that you can appreciate a trend line while simultaneously being able to like say that we should and can be better, right? Like I think that that's something that gets conflated to me sometimes, to say like, oh, things are better now than they've ever been. That's not the opposite of let's continue to make things better and all the pain points that we can point out. Yes, cool. Let's continue to go forward. If anything, this should only serve to say we can move mountains. We can continue to create a more just society.
Yeah, it's the recent parallel that I'd heard that stuck in my mind is mercy and justice are not opposites of each other. They exist in parallel to each other.
Yeah. Justin?
Man, you know, the stuff that really stuck with me, we're talking about like things that really affected our thinking and our lives. Yeah. I mean, I guess I'm trying to just name a few of a lot of like political thought stuff. The writings of Christopher Hitchens was really, really influential to me as, you know, somebody in my 20s, not only for what his opinions were, but the confidence with which he wrote them in a way that made it very clear that, yes, he wanted you to know that you could disagree with him, but you have not thought about this more than he has. And that's like, that is something that I have found to be not only in short supply, like, man, obviously for a million reasons, I wish he was still alive. But like, there are times where even as his health was failing him, Christopher Hitchens is just one of those minds I wish could see the flourishing of the social media age, because like, if it is possible, I feel like only his powers would have only grown stronger. and it really influenced for me, because he was really somebody that wanted to get out on a ledge and make a very specific pointed opinion. And I don't necessarily think that I need to do that, but I do think I need to have that same burden of don't let lack of preparation be the thing that sinks your argument. Understand where every challenge is going to come in, because that's really the only thing that you need to make sure you batten down the hatches on is understanding arguments from other sides and researching your way through it.
Man, I'm really glad to hear you phrase it that way, because I spent a fair bit of yesterday sort of making plans for disasters that have not happened yet. And we've talked about how, you know, the trope is that Napoleon was not a great tactician. He just bothered to sit down and think about everything that could go wrong beforehand and then say, well, if then, you know, what will my plan be? And as a result, it looked like he came up with brilliant strategies in the moment. But of course, he had done it all in advance. And it's a weird thing to sit down and have arguments like, where could they get me? And even and in a weird way, if we could tie this into Hearthstone, like playing Hearthstone yesterday, it was fun to say out loud, like, constantly, the way you win at Hearthstone is by understanding what the other person hopes you're going to do and figure out the thing that if you were playing that deck and that archetype that would annoy you the most, and then doing those things. Like, even though it's not what you want to do, because you're like, well, I want to play this way and what I want to do is this, that. You're like, but I know that if I was playing their deck, I know what their motivations are, and I know that this is the move that would piss them off the most, and therefore it, you know, becomes the right move. I don't know. I like that sentiment of sort of a pre-failing in imaginary scenarios and figuring out what you would do different.
One of the things to touch on Hitchens is that he thought his things through, and it's like we talked about before, like Alex Garland. Like, I may not agree with the conclusion. I may not agree, and I don't know if there's anything where I disagree with, like, Alex Garland's show devs, although that's going to be Bryce's pick, as Bryce wrote a book about how much he hated devs.
Yeah,
it's hates fine. Him. It's fine.
He calls it the devs.
Yeah, it's called devs. It's fine.
It's fine. if you're a big fat dummy, Bryce Castillo.
With Hitchens was like, you would reach a thing, like, I don't know if I agree, but I felt that argument was so eloquently made that now I understand that other point to it. I understand that other side to it. And it just, that's, that is sorely lacking. And we live in an environment where we don't really often want to entertain opposing points of view. You know, our way to handle, you know, disposing different points of view is not to understand their arguments and to disagree with them on points. It's to just not hear the argument.
And you know, I said this when he died, but if you always agreed with Christopher Hitchens, you haven't read enough Christopher Hitchens. Like, he would eventually find his way on the other side of your opinion. I feel like that's a mathematical certainty that if you read him enough, you would come to a point in which you're like, oh, he's totally wrong on that. But it laid a standard that, I mean, and this is for him doing opinion writing that I think I've tried to carry on, not only for PX3, but Raise the Dead and stuff like that going forward, while also maintaining being like captivating. Christopher Hitchens knew very, very, very well where to bring in the human elements of a story, to the point where, you know, I still remember, like, I define world elements by, like, stories that Christopher Hitchens would tell in his writing because he understood that human heartbeat.
Nice. Cool. I've got one. I go back to this once or twice a year to listen to it. It's a not exactly a lecture, but it's kind of a lecture from Brian Moriarty called "The Secret of Psalm 46." This is it's an hour long talk about game design and the relationship between creator and audience. And he layers a lot of different stories that all kind of come full circle by the end. You know, his time working at Radio Shack, and how he would learn to code on the computers, but then also talking about, like, the Battery of the Month Club and the sort of pointlessness and the very rote transaction going on between walk into the store, go to the back of the store and get this awful lead battery that's not even fully charged, and then walk out. You know, it's supposed to bring people in and supposed to make them look at the products. But at the end of the day, you just have these stores where once a month people come in and don't buy anything and don't get anything good. And that affects their experience. That's their experience. And
I hadn't realized until you said that just now that 90% of all my Radio Shack experiences was walking in, hoping that this time I'd find something irresistible, and then not doing so.
Right.
I always was in love with the possibilities and always disappointed with the reality.
Why? I loved my Battery of the Month Club card as a kid because I had that. I had my Albertsons cookie credit card too.
Ooh.
But the other thing too is Radio Shack had that. Remember that Superman comic book? That ended up being about, like, the TRS-80 or whatever they would put out?
No, that sounds awesome.
Oh, yeah, that was another thing. So, sorry, Bryce, let me interrupt.
And so he merges, that between talking about things that are awesome, you know. The work, he spends a lot of time talking about the works of Bach, a lot of time talking about the Bible, a lot of time talking about William Shakespeare, spends a lot of time talking about, and he prefaces it with the insanity of it, but he gives a very fair shake to, like, the Shakespeare authorship issue, right? Like,
whether or not it was actually
who actually wrote it, yeah. and at the end of it, I'll cut to the chase a little bit, but the short thing that you take away is, like, great things are generous and great things are giving, and that influences a lot of my work in terms of if I'm putting together a podcast, if I'm working on these shows, if I'm working on these videos, if we're coming up with ideas for things, and how the reason that we love these great works is not because they have a lot of depth, it's not because they have a lot of mystery or, you know, very sophisticated, deep, possible, Bach made all of these rounds and he hid all of these secret messages. It's because they were giving, you know, even on the surface level, they immediately gave you something that was incredible. And on top of that, they have all of these deeper levels. Or, you know, in the case of the Bible, you know, he mentions, like, the Bible may have been the only book you had when for a lot of people, the Bible is how they learn to read, how they learn to speak. Those are great things, not because they're large, and not because they're deep, but because they are giving. And so, I once or twice a year spend the time to listen to it. It's a really fantastic.
Where can I go to make sure that I hear this?
We'll have it in the show notes here. If you Google "The Secret of Psalm 46," he's got a website with an audio recording and a transcript. There's a version on YouTube. I found out about it because it itself is an Easter egg. This lecture about Easter eggs is an Easter egg in the 2016 game The Witness, where you have to sit and listen to it for 1 hour for the moon to very slowly
make
its way through a video. And so I really think it's a great listen. You know, he's a great speaker. This most recent version of it from whatever year, I guess 2010, is, like, it's a very nice recording. And it itself is free. I think it is also, in that way, a generous story.
I am unbelievably excited to hear this because it touches on what I think will be a fairly significant part of whatever this book is I'm writing, that I've thought of as the bunny on the table. I don't know if I've talked about this part, but wherever we're at now, I always go back to the very, very beginning was trying to learn to street perform. You're on a street, you have traffic, you have eyeballs, you have a story, you're ready to perform. You got your fire eating sticks and your straitjacket and everything. All you need is somebody to start performing for. And so I tried, you know, bluff and bluster. Hey, everybody gather around. We're about to have a show doing the ballet thing. Or I tried sincerely like, hey, come on over here, do me a thing. But ultimately all of those amounted to some kind of cashing in before I had earned anything. And then years later, I read a book, Be a Street Magician by David Groves. And he started all of his street performing shows by just sitting casually behind a table with a deck of cards with a bunny rabbit on the table. And he would just wait. And sooner or later, with all those eyeballs coming and going, this self-contained unit of story, what I've come to think of as the gift, the bunny on the table, would engage someone and somebody couldn't resist and would come over of their own volition and start petting the bunny rabbit. And then that was the moment that he would casually say, well, you know the rule. If you pet the bunny, you got to pick a card. And all of a sudden, after the fact, they realized they'd already self-selected and engaged. And he, what a small ask to pick a card. And before you knew it, he's doing a trick for two people that it's easy to have more people gather around. And then suddenly you're up to, you know, 70 people in a giant circle and you're wrapping up your street performance show and making money. So the idea of like, what is the gift? What is the single self-contained unit of story that you are giving to the world has always been long before you harvest that goodwill or attention has always resonated with me. So I can't believe that we haven't talked about this, yeah. But before this, I'm really excited to take a listen.
Yeah. I think all three of you would really get a kick out of listening to The Secret of Psalm 46. It's
cool.
Great. It is. Cool. It's very easy to listen to also. Andrew, do you have one?
I do. I love to read large books and things like this, but often I don't finish them. You know, you pick up like a 400-page book that's on a particular topic and it's exciting, and often you get the sort of the basic thesis and the rest of it is sort of reinforcing that. And I don't have patience. And I admit that for a guy that, you know, tries to be informed and stay on top of things, I don't finish a lot of books. I just don't. I get into it and then I'm like, oh, okay, I'm going to move on because one, maybe my attention span, two, I think the way books are written for the book market, et cetera. But also, though, sometimes you really want to get into a subject and you want to kind of dive deep and it can be intimidating. One of the things that I try to do is I try to find the least intimidating way to get into it. When I wanted to get into understand like neural networks and artificial intelligence, I would go find like beginners, like basic beginner books, things like that with pictures and, you know, cartoons. And I'd watch YouTube videos and stuff just because like I don't want to be like, oh, no, I know this. I got this. I'm going to just start as a blank slate and get into it. When I wanted to get into evolutionary psychology, things like this. The book that I read first, the book that sort of got me into understanding or looking at consciousness, not necessarily understanding it, but at least understanding the arguments. There are books by Daniel Dennett that I love that are bigger, better, whatever, Darwin's dangerous idea, etc. But a book he wrote, which was part of a series, which I thought was a fantastic series, was the Science Master series. Richard Dawkins wrote River Out of Eden, which I really recommend. It's a great book to read before you go into The Blind Watchmaker because it's most of the big arguments there and 196 pages instead of like, you know, 500. Daniel Dennett's book, Kinds of Minds Towards an Understanding of Consciousness. It's 196 pages and it is some of Daniel Dennett's best philosophical writing at the time, which is like 30 years ago now. And he's had a lot more amazing thoughts and stuff since then. And he gets into things like talking about like, you know, your arm has neurons, your arm senses pain. If you get into a car accident, and you have to reattach the arm, should you anesthetize the arm? Because there is an experience of, you know, he builds up these sort of like these philosophical arguments and how wonderful philosophers do. And that sounds like a silly example as I give it, but when you read it, you understand the context.
No, talk about I'm sorry, you're acting like it's a throwaway. My mind is already blown. Like, oh my God, yeah. To what extent is the pain conscious in my arm that is severed from my body?
And then he gets into it, and he has a lot of these. And that's what I love about Daniel Dennett is he has these wonderful ways of looking at these things where it's not necessarily you have to agree with his conclusions, but his arguments, his philosophical arguments, like, well, let's look at it like this and let's explore where this goes. Because if we worry about like the pain that a lobster feels, you know, but it doesn't have this pain center, but it does have these. What about this or what about that? And not therefore you're wrong. But more of like just this, he is one of my favorite people in philosophy, particularly in consciousness, et cetera, because his arguments, and I mean his thought puzzles, his thought experiments, let's use that term, are wonderful. And I think that it is a great, great, great example. Kinds of Minds, I thought it was a great example of that. And once you get into that, then you can start getting into other stuff by him. And yeah, there's a lot of wonderful books in that series. There was The Periodic Kingdom, which is a wonderful overview of, you know, how he came up with the you know, the periodic table. I mean, just great stuff. And just that basic book series, I'm a big fan. I wish there was more like it. It's easily digestible. You can finish them in one or two sittings, and you walk away with a deeper understanding, and then you're really well prepared to pick up a topic and go into it at a deeper level.
Right on.
So nice.
I sent you all the image though of the Radio Shack comic.
It's so great. Superman. So funny.
Yeah, the computer that saved Metropolis, the TRS-80 feature, computer whiz kids and Superman, you know, dealing with a hurricane. So just lovely. Simpler times when a trash 80 can save the world.
Look at that. Yeah. TV computer.
Oh, Bryce.
You'll never know the joy of when an audio tape cassette player attached to a Commodore 64 finally finished uploading Beachhead. I mean, it's like, yeah. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, waiting a half an hour to play Frogger. I'm done. It's been after.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.